Vale, doncs comencem la segona sessió de la visita del Dave. Ara m'he donat compte que us he pensat ja alguns articles que em va donar el Dave per vosaltres, però m'he donat compte que només els he pensat a la classe de tercer, i que els de quart encara no els tenim. Perdó, després de la classe us faré també pels de quart. So, Dave?
Thank you. Okay, well again, yesterday I said I wasn't going to talk about organized crime. So organized crime in the sense that we mean criminal organizations. But actually I just realized that we are going to talk, one, in a kind of analogy for organized crime today, but also in reality. And I want to talk about an example that's very important at the moment in the news in Catalonia, but Spain really, which is the case of the Prestige oil tanker, which everyone knows this case. Yeah, I'm looking at the Scottish guy. Yeah, you know, it rings a bell. Okay, I'm going to talk about it very, very briefly. In fact, I might just make some points and then maybe Ignacy could also, yeah? Because essentially, okay, I have a couple of slides. Probably the largest ecological disaster in Spain and Portugal's history. Probably, right? I mean, we're talking, in terms of the polluted, the number of beaches polluted, right up the Portuguese coast, and then the Galicia coast, Cantabria, Asturias, the Basque Country, France. We're talking about 1,000 beaches polluted, that's what they estimate. I mean, huge spilling of oil, maybe 20 million US gallons, so maybe 76,000 meters square of oil in the first instance. Huge disaster, which I know most of you, I don't need to tell you this because it's part of Spain's history, a very important part of Spain's history, but killed for at least 2 years, I think, the Galician fishing industry. I mean, absolutely killed probably the most important area of fishing in Europe. So it's hugely important. Now, it's a crucial case for all kinds of reasons. And I want to use this case because we can make some links, I think, to some other events that happened that you won't know about. But I want to use this case to show two or three things. Firstly, that I don't think we can understand corporate crime without understanding the role of the state. That's the first point, yeah? And I think we can say that the state is involved somehow indirectly or directly in corporate crime always. Now, we'll talk about that in relation to this case. I also think that corporate crime very often can't be understood unless we understand actually the international scene or the international situation. See? See? No. I don't know. Okay. And really, I want to talk about this case in relation to some things that happened in the UK 2 years later. And I think the Prestige disaster is somehow connected to the deaths of 23 migrant workers in the UK 2 years later. Okay, how could that be possible? I'm going to explain. I want to talk about the case, first of all. The case raises all kinds of issues about globalization and the globalization of corporations and the way particularly shipping companies work. So, this was Greek operated, the captain was Greek. Although the owners seem to be Greek, there's kind of questions about who really owned the company. Registered in the Bahamas under a flag of convenience, and ships normally register in some countries because it's easier to have them licensed and it's easier for them to then operate. So it was registered in the Bahamas, and then the company that actually owns was registered in Liberia. again, for reasons which make them relatively invisible and perhaps outside the regulations that they would normally be liable to if they were registered in Greece or Spain or the UK or, you know, whatever. This is very common in the shipping industry, that you have very unclear idea of who actually owns and where it's owned and those kind of questions for regulatory purposes, to enable the company to be kind of ambiguous, and it's not clear which regulations that they are liable for. There's another series of questions about what happened. So it was very clear the ship was in trouble at an early stage. Okay, the captain has been accused of not acting early enough when it was clear that the ship was breaking up, but essentially there was a split in the hull of the ship. It looks like not just the Spanish, but the French and the Portuguese authorities demanded that the ship be moved out to sea. At one point, I think the Spanish authorities helped them tow the ship out to sea, and this was the crucial point where the hull was broken and the major spillage happened. So big questions about why those authorities, those government authorities, did this at that moment. And the suspicion is, of course, that if you bring something like this, even though it may be safer, into sea, the damage in terms of public reputation, governments having to answer to the public for this, the judgment was made that this was probably more damaging. This is the kind of rudimentary aspects of the case that I know about. I don't know if you want to add anything to this, Ignacio.
I think that you know about the case more than me.
Okay.
So I think if they cannot understand something like that, I can help you.
Okay.
I know that today, I think we're starting the process. I don't know if you know that it's Ulises Lagertías. Había estado parando una noticia y creo que Abuyo da más o menos a Ulises. And there are four people, I don't know their name,
prosecuted. Yeah.
Yeah. El director de la Marina Mercante Español y otro tipo de pues, nombres tuyos que también, ¿no? Diego, pero no son más de
eso. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the key, the key issues. The trial is interesting because, you know, I think given yesterday's discussion, obviously we can clearly describe this as something which is punishable. Whether it will be punished remains to be seen. And it's interesting that they are looking at the owner at different levels of the organisation, right? So they're looking at the captain and, you know, and the owner. And this tells us something about the point I made yesterday about very often how those offences that occur in corporations occur because of a result of things happening at different levels of the organisation. And I think this will come out in the trial. There's another aspect to this which I think is interesting, because the Spanish government tried to take the American Bureau of Shipping to court a few years ago, because the American Bureau of Shipping had certified the ship as safe. And there are big questions when the two sister ships, I can't remember the names, I think I've got them noted here, but the Alejandros and Centaur had also been inspected under this American program which certifies the hull, the place where the oil is being stored. And so the other two ships actually ended up being trashed, being dismantled. And so there were big questions about why this ship was allowed to continue. When Spain, the Spanish government, took the case against this American body who certified the ship six years before the disaster, the court ruled that the Spanish government couldn't be compensated because the US government had never signed the international treaty which allowed them to be sued. So I don't know if you get that fully, but because the American government had never signed the international treaty which allows governments to claim compensation, then they couldn't claim compensation. This is an international treaty that almost every government has signed. But the US is powerful enough to not include itself. And there are similar issues about the International Criminal Court. So there are some provisions that the US has exempted itself from in the International Criminal Court. So we can say, I think, in this case, that there's a kind of vacuum in international law in different ways. And that there are different ways in which different parties are trying to escape responsibility. And it's interesting, actually, that ultimately responsibility is coming down to individuals in the courts in Spain. And the corporation itself, the wider corporation, is not going to be dealt with in a criminal proceeding. And none of the governments involved seem to be held accountable in those kind of proceedings. So I think it's a very important case in terms of illuminating things that we talked about yesterday, but some of the things that we're going to talk about today. There's a wider story, and I've talked about this kind of consequence. When we talk about the consequences of corporate crime, and this goes back to the very first point I made yesterday, I think we have to think about social consequences which are way beyond anything we can imagine when it comes to individual interpersonal or street crime. I mean, way beyond. The consequences very often are way beyond the things that we can imagine. There were thousands and thousands of volunteers in the West Spanish coast and the North Spanish coast and in the Portuguese coast who volunteered to clear up the... You'll remember this, right? You know, armies of people who volunteered to clear up what's happened now. The company and the governments are not, I don't think, being adequately questioned for what happened for the initial events. But there's absolutely no I might be wrong, right? I might be proven wrong. I hope I'm proven wrong. I think there's no chance of the people, now that we know who were made ill in the clear-up. A lot of people with serious lung problems, health problems, who as a consequence of this disaster, have been made ill. This is, comes from a study of those volunteers. I don't think there's been many studies of what's happened in the long term to local communities, and I think this is another big issue as well. What has happened to the local communities? Of course, there are major economic impacts on the Galician fishing industry. Another unknown consequence, and I think there will be many, but this is what I know about because this place, Morecambe Bay, is just up the water from Liverpool, where I live. It's not very far. And in 2004, there were 23 Chinese cockle pickers and cockle, I'm not going to say the word cockle, but... And essentially, it's a very difficult... I don't know if you know anything about this job, but it's a very specialised job, and you need to know, especially in this area, because the tide, the sea moves in and out very, very quickly. So you need to know exactly... Not just how the tide behaves, but you need to know at a particular time of year how much time you have, and this happened. I can't remember exactly the date, but in the winter, and at this period they only had 3 to 4 hours of safety on the beach where they could pick the mariscos. So they only had a very limited. Amount of time. And normally, I'm saying these are Chinese cockle pickers, these were people who had been smuggled into Britain because they came from very poor areas in China. They were working in very tough conditions everywhere they worked. This is documented. They had several jobs around the country. They just had to move wherever there was work. They were being paid a fifth of the wages of local people at the time and being made to work much longer hours. And crucially, had no idea of how dangerous the work that they were doing was. Absolutely crucial. Why is this related to the prestige? Okay, I'll tell you what happened first. They were stranded in the dark in the middle of the night. They should never have been there in the middle of the night. No local worker would have been there in the middle of the night. They were stranded. It's a huge beach, so they were maybe 3 kilometres out, and the tide came in very quickly, and they were stranded and they drowned. And it was a very traumatic trial. The only person who was prosecuted was the Chinese gangmaster, the Chinese organiser of the work at the time. And in the trial, there was a lot of mobile phone recordings of people phoning home to China when they were dying, and all. It's a very, very tragic story that's been told actually in quite a famous film in the UK called Ghosts, and in several books the story's been told as well. So it's I think, very important part of our culture, in fact. And the biggest industrial disaster that we experienced since the oil rig disaster I talked about yesterday. So very, very important. Why is it related to the Prestige? Well, what happened in the 2 years after the Prestige disaster was the global price of Mari Escos went high, and there was a demand, there was a shortage, and especially because Galicia was such an important producer of this kind of food. So there was pressure on the global market to find this kind of seafood from around the world. And in Morecambe Bay, it meant that the intensification of work in the area became much more heightened. So people were expected to work longer hours, and there was more competition, more people came to the area because of the market pressures of the shortage. And a Spanish company called Conservas Dani, the household name. Well, they bought a Welsh company, a company from Wales, and that Welsh company had previously been dealing with local cockle merchants. So previously just been dealing, the market had been quite stable, the Welsh company bought from this English fishermen and fisherwomen, they were just the local people that they bought the cockles from. And I'm not blaming this, I'm not saying this is a Spanish problem, but I think this is a corporate problem. So the big company comes in and says, okay, we'll deal with anyone who gets us the cheapest mariscos. So they were buying from everyone, to try and push the price down So this had consequences for the local people who pick the fish, who of course blame the Chinese. I don't blame the Chinese, but they blame the Chinese because they can't see this bigger, they have never heard of the fucking Prestige, right? They don't know, excuse me for they've never heard of the Prestige. So why would they not, you know, they blame the things that they see closest to them, right? I think they're wrong. And I think that those ideas, particularly in Britain right now, there's a lot of racism against migrant workers. I think because people can't see those wider pressures, but that's another discussion. So Conservas Dani is buying cheap cockles. It means the Chinese cockle pickers who have to work because they owe money to the people who took them from China. They're under, it's almost like slave labor. They have to work long hours for this international company ultimately to continue the supply of the mariscos. So, I think I've made it clear. There's a link, there's a direct link between what happened to the deaths of those cockle pickers, which is never described as corporate crime. I think we can describe it as corporate crime. Not just because I don't think the only criminal corporation is Conservas Dani here. I think it's also the smaller companies that were employing the cockle pickers. And I think also we have to ask big questions of the British government. British government did nothing to protect the safety of those workers. The British government, like governments here, spends a lot of money and energy and time chasing migrants and harassing migrants and trying to keep them out of the country. Doesn't spend any time protecting migrants at work. And actually in law, this is something nobody really realised until this happened, but in law, undocumented workers, illegal workers, have the same rights to protection as legal workers. We don't distinguish in the UK in law between human beings. If you're a human being, you should be protected at work, whether you've got papers or not. But the government never does anything to make sure that these people are protected at work. So, this also raises big questions, I think, about the state and the role of the state and the extent to which we can even maybe think about this as a state crime. Both the Prestige and what happened in Morecambe Bay. So, I wanted to introduce this because I think it frames a lot of what we're going to talk about today. So, theoretically, I think we have to think about states and corporations as interdependent. I don't think we can think about this in any other way. We're actually taught to think differently. I think from a very kind of early stage in our education, we're brought up to think that there is a very, very clear distinction between the private sphere and the public sphere, you know, and I think probably especially in the UK, I think more than here, we are expected. We're taught that the, you know, democracy works in the public sphere. The public, the governments are held accountable to us as individuals. And this is different from the private sphere, where power operates entirely differently, where people are free to invest money, to make choices, in private markets, and so on. Different from the public sphere, where we have public authorities that provide us with services, make the laws, protect us, fight wars for us, and so on, right? I mean, I was talking yesterday about some areas where this is beginning to become obvious that there's not so clear a distinction. I talked about private military companies. So, actually, some private companies are fighting wars. So there's a shading of the private sector into the public sector. I think we also have to think about this more structurally. And all of the corporations, all of the household names, all of the brands that everybody that I'm wearing, that you're wearing today, I think those companies would be nothing unless states provided an infrastructure. I don't know what an infrastructure is. Okay. So an infrastructure, whether that's an infrastructure of economy, an economic infrastructure, a legal infrastructure, a social infrastructure, or even basic things like providing roads and transportation and telephone cables, internet, and so on, right? So it's crucial that we understand that modern corporations would not exist unless there was a legal, economic, and political infrastructure provided by states. It's obvious, I'm not saying anything new, it's obvious, you know, when you think about it. But the point is, it begins to make us think, okay, maybe these are not separate spheres entirely. Maybe we should be thinking about them as entirely separate spheres. Similarly, modern states, particularly under in capitalist social orders, and most of the world now is capitalist. Some places don't call themselves capitalist, but they are. But in the contemporary world, most states are dependent upon the economic activities of their corporations, right? Of their private corporations. I think, personally, probably governments do too much to defend their corporations. But, and I'm not saying this is an inevitable or a process that is part of, you know, what it means to be a democracy. I think there are alternatives. But the way most governments work, they link their fortunes to the fortunes of their corporations. Now, I don't know if anyone remembers 2 years ago, it was big news because it was a British company, but BP, who are now called
Evolut
or something, yeah, in Spain they changed the name. But the company BP is a British Petroleum, it used to be called the company. Do you know, kind
yeah,
of know?
Yeah, BP, and now it's BP Evolut or something.
Okay, they had a big disaster 2 summers ago in the Gulf of Mexico. Some of you remember. There was an explosion in the Gulf of Mexico and it leaked a lot of oil. The most interesting thing for me, because this was halfway through Obama's term, so he had to be showing himself to be quite macho and assertive. And he demanded that the president of BP come to the White House, into the Oval Office, and he had to meet with him and tell him whatever he had to tell him. But it was a very nationalist discourse. It was this American president telling this British company that the Yanks won't allow the Brits to do this in our soil. It was really interesting, national. And the front page of all the British newspapers, including the one I showed you yesterday, had headlines like, Mr. Cameron, who's the British Prime Minister, stand up for your country. Stand up for your company. It was amazing. It was like, you know, the country becomes the company. And I think increasingly, I think it's something that characterizes the stage of capitalism that we're in now. But we have more and more this idea that the national future of the nation is tied up with the future of companies. I'm sure there are examples in Spain. Yeah. Okay. So it's like, yeah, Repsol and Argentina, of course. I saw this. Yeah. It's a good example. So, I call it market patriotism. I think there's a form of market patriotism that's intensifying at the moment. But, never mind. The point is, that we, if we accept this point, we see that states and corporations are actually quite integrated in the same structure of power. And I think that makes us think beyond this very strict separation that we're taught to kind of believe in. And of course, when it comes to the regulation of corporate crime, we expect states to intervene and regulate corporations on our behalf. We, just in the same way I was describing about the way we expect the police to protect us and what happens when that breaks down, it's a serious problem, right? What happens when the police attack us instead of protecting us, it becomes a crisis, not just in terms of physically, but a crisis in terms of how we think about the notion of protection or the state and so on. The same point about the regulation of corporations. If there is this close relationship between corporations and states, what does that mean when we expect the state to protect us from corporations? You know, from when we expect the state to say, okay, the chicken is safe to eat, and that we have regulators which make sure that, or you know, it's safe to work here, or you know, you're not going to dump any toxic waste in Tarragona's rivers, or you know, whatever it might be. Yeah. So, I think we have to say that also the control of corporate crime is limited by this relationship very often. And I'll say more about that later. But the control of corporate crime is very often limited by this very interdependent relationship. And I think that's crucial. Okay, but now I'm going to go back in time for a moment and talk about the history, some of the stuff I kind of mentioned. Sorry, I keep moving. I've got a microphone here. I really want to pick it up and kind of start, but I can't. Something is not really in me, you know. I wish it was, but you know. Okay, but what I do think, what is in me, is an understanding, a very kind of sketchy understanding of what I've been talking about in this interdependence in a historical context. And I think this is really crucial for us to understand. And I am talking, and I kind of apologise because I'm talking from a perspective of British history rather than a perspective of Spanish history, but I think there's a very similar, and I mean Spanish history because I'm thinking about the history of empire here, rather than specifically Catalonian history. Look, for me there were crimes involved in colonialism that have never been described as crimes. Really, and it's astounding to me. When you land in someone's country and you kill them and take all their possessions and their land, that's a theft, right? You know, that's like, whether it happened 500 years ago or now is a theft, right? And really, I think the principle of legitimized theft, and of course it wasn't just as simple as theft because there were very complex ideas for the Spanish and for the British that legitimized those crimes of colonialism. I think in Britain, I think the British colonialists were the best liars, actually. I think they had the most incredible lies. Probably, you know, because the I think the complexity of how religion was used in the British case is probably more incredible, but that's just me. The key lie for me which legitimized the theft of land and colonialization was the theory of John Locke, and he had the theory of property which basically argued that if you did not produce and you did not make full use of the land, and the only way to make full use of the land was through cultivating the land and settling it in a regular way, in the same way that the Europeans did, if you don't do that, then you're not entitled to that land. Because you're not doing God's work. God's work is settled work. God's work is when people settle down and plant the vegetables that they have been planting for years. And if the people in the Americas don't do that, then we are entitled to land. If the people in Australia don't do that, we are entitled to their land. That was essentially the John Locke's theory of lack, which was tied to his theory of property. So no matter how far you dress that up, colonialism was about the capture of spaces, it was about the capture of resources, and ultimately, latterly, it was about the capture of slaves and the shipping of slaves, particularly in the British case, from West Africa to the Caribbean and North America in order to work. And for many years, of course, this was legal. Everything I'm talking about was made legal by the ideology I'm talking about, but also by very rudimentary forms of international law. This is what I'm... The John Locke's theory of property was rudimentary international law, was the start of international law. So it wasn't until the end of the 19th century when the British made the slave trade illegal that we can talk about these kind of things as crimes. Yeah, it's exactly the same point I made yesterday. These things were not punishable before they were made illegal in that sense. But I cannot see how we can talk about Spanish colonialism, Italian colonialism, German colonialism, British colonialism without talking about a notion of law and a notion of crime. I think we can't, it's impossible. And then when we come into the period in which capitalism develops, particularly, and I've looked at the US in detail because there's some key cases, I've looked at the UK in detail, in the 19th century, very, very important periods, mid to the end of the 19th century, where we see capitalism really developing at a fast pace. And one of the things we see in the US is the development of the frontier through the railroads, the opening up the steel industry allows the railroads to be built, which opens up the oil and coal and other mineral industries, but also opens up some of the hinterlands to be occupied. It's an incredible period, and if you ever get a chance to read, and I've forgotten the author, you know the book The Robber Barons? It's written in 1930. It's like a great... I'll find it out for you. I'll find it out and we'll put it on the virtual campus. Definitely, because it's a really, really important book. Mark Twain, you know the guy who wrote Huckleberry Finn? I don't know if that's part of your culture, maybe. So Mark Twain used the phrase robber barons and basically talked about those early capitalists as very, very... more powerful, actually, than most of the public officials of the time, because they were able to accumulate wealth very, very quickly and concentrate wealth very, very quickly, very often by simple acts of deception and theft. This is how the history of the robber barons go. And Mark Twain wrote about this, and there are several histories which say, look, American capitalism would not have developed in this way unless there had been routine criminal theft on a grand scale, on a scale that's almost unimaginable. The same thing happened in the UK. The period of expansion of the factories, of industrialisation in the UK, the most intense period was during the early 19th century. And it was in that period that the British society began to realise that capitalism was unsustainable. Completely unsustainable because there was no regulation in the factories. Children were working, of all ages, children as young as 2 were working in factories. In some parts of the country, there's a part where they make ceramic potteries. It's in kind of in the middle of the country near Birmingham. They now have a Premiership team. Some of you may have heard of Stoke, maybe not, but some of you might have come across this. But it was where they're very famous for British pottery craft. In the 1820s, the life expectancy of a ceramic worker in Stoke was 19. So people entered the factory maybe 9, 10, 11, 12. They weren't expected to live longer than 5 years. So this was recognised very early on by the government, by social reformers, and by workers' organisations themselves that had begun to form, that this was unacceptable. There was no regulation, there was no law to prevent children and women working incredibly long hours and everyone being worked to death. So the very first regulations to control corporate crime, or some people claim these are the first systematic regulations, laws, to control corporate crime were introduced from about 1803 was the first Factory Act in the UK. It's a very, very important history, very interesting history, because some of the first laws said if you're a factory owner and you make children work for longer than 14 hours, you go to jail. That's what they said. Because this was the early days of the development of the criminal law, the law was showing itself to be equal, and they knew, actually they knew that the factory system couldn't be sustained because it was killing the raw materials that they needed. It was killing the workers that they needed. Okay. No factory owner ever went to jail. So there were factory acts in 1803, then in 1830, 1833, right through the 19th century. And many of them had carried the penalty of jail. No factory owner ever went to jail, for the same reason that Sutherland argued. Because no judge would ever send a respectful member of the same class to jail. And what happened is a kind of complex history, but we don't need to go into this, because the point I'm making is that crime, factory crime, was routine, absolutely routine, part and parcel of that life. There's also an important history that's written by a guy called George Robb, who wrote a book, White Collar Crime in England, in Victorian England. And in this period, the profits from the factories were very important in stimulating the finance industry. So the growth of the banking sector, banking and finance in the UK in this same period. And the banking, if we think the banking sector is fraudulent now, I mean, it's exactly the same in the 19th century. Because they had huge sums of money that people needed to invest that were coming from the colonial activities and from the factories and were then being recycled. I'm not going to go into this history in detail, but there was routine financial fraud in the banking sector in England in the 19th century, no doubt about it. And in fact, some people did get sent to jail, but that's another story. Because still in the UK, I think, financial fraud is maybe not taken seriously, but it's taken more seriously than killing people at work, than killing workers. Stealing from investors is taken more seriously than killing workers. I think that's something we see in the US as well. The point I'm trying to make about this is that at the crucial stages of capitalist development, we see a very, very clear link between states and corporations and through which crime is being produced. And sometimes controlled, sometimes regulated, but being produced. So, I think we see a history which tells us that crime is intimately related to the development of capitalism. Well, corporate crime and state crime. I'm not going to talk about this for very long, but I think this guy Charles Tilley is a very important thinker in relation to what we're talking about, but makes a slightly different point. He argues and he compares states to organized crime, and I don't know if there's a similar phrase in Catalan, which is means protection racket. But I don't know what how it would translate. Okay, so you know this text. Excellent. Okay. So I think the key point about this text, and I won't spend too much time.
Yeah, I meant the umbrella text, the second book. So I suppose to have read the text.
Okay, so let's assume every single person here has read the text and remembers it. And then we can move on. Okay, great. I don't even have to say anything. No. Okay. Let me just talk about the concept. Okay, so you know the text. The concept, and this is where we get back to what we normally call organized crime or criminal organizations. The typical model of criminal organizations is that, you know, they have muscle. They have some kind of ability. And, you know, I don't know if you know the kind of Weber, Max Weber notion of the state having a monopoly of legitimate force. That's something that some of you may be kind of, yeah, familiar with. The point about organized crime is that they can kind of challenge the state's monopoly of force because they have the ability to exert force, right? I'm saying they, as if we know who they are. Okay, I'm talking about an idealized notion, stereotype of organized crime, right? Something that I think is essential to powerful and strong criminal organizations is that they're able to exert force, whether it's economic force or physical force or some kind of force. And very often that model takes the form of a protection racket. We protect you, and you pay us for it somehow, right? Or we give you some benefit of services and you pay us for it. Look, a case I know where this operated in a very clear way is the north of Ireland. Some of you might have heard of the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, which was stereotyped as a terrorist organisation, had incredible support amongst Republican communities in the north of Ireland because they were able to give people security. They defended people against the army, against other paramilitary organisations, and very often provided services like bus services or taxi services, sometimes even providing people with housing, in fact. And this is a kind of protection racket. And Tilly, as you know, because you've read it, argues that this is merely what states do. So the structure of what states do is actually very, very similar to the structure of how we think about organised crime. And the history of that structure is very important. Okay, so you know that. That's not my main point. My main point is I think we can talk about this structure in relation to the relationship between states and corporations. And I don't think you will have read this guy. I'd be surprised if you got them to read this guy, because he's not very... he's quite obscure. But if you do a Google search on this guy, all of his texts are online for free, and I encourage you to do so. His name's Smedley Butler. Great name. Smedley Butler was the most senior military officer at one point in the US in the 1930s. And he wrote a great book, short book, called War is a Protection Racket. And all his texts are online. And basically, this guy served the American military for years and then came out of the American military and started talking to people and doing tours and saying, look, I've just realized what my role is. My role in Central America and Latin America has been essentially to control those republics on behalf of American business, for fruit companies, for banking companies, for oil companies. He saw himself as part of a protection racket. Yeah, so he went into countries where he would make a deal with the government, and they would say, okay, we won't kill you if you let our banana company come here and take your bananas, and you can stay in power, and so on. Look, this is oversimplifying things. But if you read Butler, he's a very, very clear, as clear an idea as anyone, because he's in the middle of it, of what's going on. And he sees his role in terms of that state-corporate relationship as being one of a protection racket. I think the best way we can think about this, and the only way we can think about this, is about mutually reinforcing power. Governments, militaries, mutually reinforcing the power of corporations who, through their economic activities, mutually reinforce the power of the elites who are in control of government. I know this sounds like a very boiled down, simplified version, and we're talking about very, very complex things. But I do think that's what we see at the heart of state corporate crime. And I think maybe, is it time for a break? Or,
yeah.
Then we can develop this in the second half. Okay, thank you.